Host this time. This hour we have five stories for you. We'll hear about a family of amateur detectives, pole dancing, wheelchair waltzing, forgiveness in an airport, and finally, love of a not-so-platonic nature. This episode is a celebration of the Moth Story Slam. The first four stories are from these open mic story competitions. The Moth is always on the hunt for great stories, but at the Story Slams, the storytellers find us. We provide a stage, a theme, a host, and some judges, and the storytellers show up and bring it on. As with all competitions, there are also rules. The hard and fast rules are true stories only, stay within the time limit, stick to the theme, no stand-up, no rants, no essays, no lectures. The softer rules, the ones we know can make or break a story, include your story must have stakes, define the dilemma, and also your story must feature you, meaning you can't tell a whole story about your grandmother when she was a little girl. You weren't even born yet. Storytellers need to be in the stories. We're often asked what kinds of people line up to tell stories at the Story Slams, and there really is no set demographic. Beyond the mix of gender, race, and religion, there's also a blend of funny people and earnest people, shy types, loud types, old and young, snarky or kindly. The 10 names pulled from the hat and the stories they tell are a surprise each and every time. Our first story is from Steve Zimmer. He's someone we've heard from many times at the Story Slams. In fact, he's told more slam stories than anyone in our history. This is one he shared for a show with the theme Revenge. Here's Steve Zimmer, live at the Moth.
In our section of Niles, Illinois, all the backyards measure exactly 30 feet by 40 feet. But the Dwyer's backyard is first among equals. It has a pool that's surrounded by this big wood deck that gets about 4 feet high. Sometimes when the Dwyers are having a pool party, I'll sneak through a gap in the fence and crawl undetected beneath the deck. And then I can look through gaps in the wood and spy on people at the party. So this did not happen recently. I was 8 years old. But this deck, with its sunlit surface and troll-infested underworld, kind of sums up the neighborhood, which at this time is in the middle of a crime wave. 6 burglaries in the last 4 months. They begin shortly after my family moves in. We're innocent, but cannot escape the observation that everything was fine until that weird family showed up. Now, in truth, my parents aren't that weird. The stigma is partly from just from being strangers at a time when people are scared, and partly from me. At this age, I'm deeply religious, love animals, and have severe ADD. It's a devastating combination that results in several elaborate backyard funerals for rescued animals I forgot to feed. All of which gets witnessed by the neighbors out of context. After a couple more burglaries, a neighborhood watch forms. Like all neighborhood watches, it suffers from the problem that nobody wants to be doing the watch at 3 a.m. when you really need it. And the problem's doubled in our neighborhood because, you know, being assigned an early time gets to be kind of a status symbol, and so everybody wants dusk, you know, which is not a sweet spot for burglaries. My parents offered to join the watch. The neighbors have apparently anticipated this offer and formulated a polite way to say no. They welcome us on as reserves. We know it's the Dwyers who blocked us. They're the Alpha family, very popular, especially their two oldest kids, Tim, who's 16, and Jeanette, who's 15. Even though the Dwyers live right next door to us, they never say hello or invite us to any of their pool parties, including their upcoming huge Hawaiian luau party, which gets half the neighborhood. I nonetheless secretly attend this event. Crawling underneath the deck as the luau rages above me. Near the center of the party, I can hear Mr. Dwyer holding court. And, you know, he's known for being, you know, very funny, and he's got everybody laughing about something, which turns out to be my parents. I'm not popular in school, but hearing that my parents are unpopular is way worse. The following week, we have the Zimmer family luau, featuring Zimmers, pineapple marinated ham, and despair. My parents take this opportunity to announce that we're going to do our own neighborhood watch. Now, arguably, this sounds like, you know, the social isolation really is making them weird, but I don't think that's it. I think they just want a way for my little brother and I to actively cope with our fear of all these break-ins. I've been having dreams about the burglars coming into our house. I must be a conservative kid because the burglars are always hippies, and they laugh and give us the peace sign as they're mishandling my coin collection and shooting us full of holes. But my little brother is more deeply affected. He'll just get up in the middle of the night and look at the street, you know, just watch the street for hours. He was 5 years old. So we start doing the Zimmer family neighborhood watch for an hour every night, and it's a great childhood memory. Just sitting with my mom, looking out the upstairs window, and we can see 12 backyards, and you know, we talk, and I have her full attention. Or walking around with my dad, and unlike the official watchers, we do a different route each evening, because my dad says that, you know, burglars just love it if you do the same route every evening. My dad also says that, you know, at this hour, you know, you should look more at, you know, the cars than the houses. He says, keep an eye out for suspicious people in a crummy car, which unfortunately describes our family. My parents fight a lot. They're even unpopular with each other. But this one time, they put it aside. The burglars and the neighbors have conspired through this watch to push us together. It's the closest I'll ever feel to my family, and the most hopeful about how things will turn out for us, because I've been convinced that something horrible is going to happen. 2 months later, the end of summer, specifically Friday, September 1st, I'm asleep. It's a warm night, which means two things. I'm wearing my orange summer pajamas, and the window's open. Around 2 a.m., something brushes against my leg. I pretend I'm still asleep. There's whispers and warm breath near my face. Then someone grabs my arm. It's my little brother who I share the bedroom with. I'm like, what? And he's like, the Dwyers are getting robbed. So we go and look out the window, and sure enough, there's no cars in the driveway, and their house is dark except for one light on in the basement. So we wake up our mom, and she calls the cops and wakes up our dad, in that order. This is our big chance. We're going to save the Dwyers. So the police show up, several squad cars, lights, sirens, and they pull five very sketchy-looking teenage guys out of the Dwyer's basement, along with Tim and Jeanette Dwyer. Hey, by now, half the neighborhood's out walking their dog, even if they don't have a dog. And our front yard becomes the center of the universe, and you know, everyone's talking at once, like, who are those, you know, five other kids? Why are the police questioning them? Are they criminals? I've never seen them before. They're definitely not from around here. Which is really strange because Tim and Jeanette have so many friends in the neighborhood. Yeah, my kids are friends with them. A couple months ago, we had them in our house. How come there's no cars in front of the Dwyers? Tim used to come over after baseball. 2 months ago, they were in our house. People start connecting the dots between parties and homework sessions and sleepovers and the burglaries. In the last year and a half, Tim and Jeanette had been in the homes of every single one of the victims. There's no arrests, but the neighborhood watch turns into Watch the Dwyers, and the burglaries stop cold. That night changes everything. The Dwyers are disgraced and eventually move away. The neighborhood is safe. And we're no longer the weird family. We're the weird family you don't f*** with.
That was Steve Zimmer. By day, he's a programmer who works in financial systems. But by night, he tells stories. In fact, at the time of this recording, he's told a whopping 77 stories at the Moth. I sat down with Steve to ask him how he came to be so prolific.
I'd always wanted to write, but I have horrible ADD. Yeah, just horrible. And I can't write, sit down and do anything. But, at the Moth, you have you get assigned a topic every, because they post the themes. And it's like being assigned a theme is really frees you up. And then, you have a time limit and, it's very important to have borders if you have ADD. And also that you're doing it in front of a bunch of people really makes you get it done.
Now, Steve, are you someone anyone would consider a bon vivant at a party, for instance, or someone who was like, gather around, I'm going to tell a tale?
Not really. A lot of the reason I like storytelling is because, if I go to a dinner party or something, unless I really know the people well, I kind of just sit there, and then afterwards I kind of think of all the things I wish I'd said, and it'll keep me up. And the Moth is you get to think of everything and then say it, because you have all these things you wish you said, and then you tell the story, and in the story you're and they're da da da, and what I should have said was, and then it could still be funny when you're telling the story. Where in real life you missed your chance.
We're hoping Steve Zimmer might have inspired you to tell a story. We'd love to hear from you. Call our pitch line at 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. Leave a short message. Pitch us a story with stakes. Plot it out before you call, but don't read it. We want to hear your natural voice. And skip to the good part. You only have about a minute. Our next story is from Amy Rude, who showed up at one of our Chicago story slams. The theme that night was jokers. Quick warning, the story is not particularly graphic, but does attempt to deconstruct sexiness. Here's Amy Rude, live at the Moth Story Slam.
My sex life is a comedy. Like a lot of people, I use humor to handle difficult situations. And when I met my husband Dan in 2002, I was recovering from both a sexual assault and 20 years as a Catholic. So sex was definitely a difficult situation. So as the relationship progressed and sex entered the picture, it wasn't long before what Dan ironically refers to as sexy time involved using body parts as microphones, tap dancing, bad stand-up comedy. I developed a habit of including, "You've been a wonderful audience, don't forget to tip your server," into every interaction. So I don't do sexy unless skits and musical numbers or your kind of foreplay. And they're really not for Dan. But he's a good sport about it. I think, A, because he thinks it's funny in spite of himself. And two, because there's also sex. But he's the sort of person that makes me want to be a better person and a better wife, and a better wife would do sexy instead of going full on court jester every time we take our clothes off. But I'm in way over my head when it comes to sexy. I don't know how you do it. I don't know what it looks like on me. But I thought I found the answers last winter when my friend Michelle mentioned how much she was enjoying her pole dancing classes. And the light bulb went on. And then a Groupon showed up in my email the next day. And I thought, that's a sign, right? So we make plans to go to this pole dancing class on a Friday night. And being the librarian that I am, I'm like, I need to do some research on this. And so I go to the website and I learn four things. From the class description, I learned that everybody gets sexy in there, no matter how awkward or shy you are to start with. Score. that beginners should wear long pants to avoid any kind of pole burn situation. That they serve cocktails there, which seems really weird for a workout place. And that they also have a very strict cancellation policy, which is good to know when Friday morning rolls around and Michelle cancels. And it's too late for me to cancel without losing one of those Groupon classes. And I'm also kind of thinking maybe this will be easier if nobody I know is there to witness this. So I decide to go by myself, which I realize when I get there is a really bad idea. I go into the locker room where I'm swallowed up by two very large and boisterous bachelorette parties. And it gets even worse when I go into the class where it's 1992 and I'm at a casting call for a Sir Mix-a-Lot video. There are a lot of very buxom women in crop tops and shiny hot pants. Whereas I had chosen to take the website's advice to the letter and was wearing long pants and a long sleeve t-shirt in sensible cotton fabrics. So then our teacher comes in and she looks like this kind of stripper Barbie and she puts on this really loud music that I can't hear anything over and starts a warm-up. And when I say warm-up, I mean spreading your legs, spanking your ass, making sexy eyes at yourself in the mirror while you flip your hair around. Or that's what everybody else was doing while I did this Frankenstein robot, deer in the headlights pantomimed puppet show. And then she starts showing us some moves on the pole and spinning around and mostly just making myself dizzy. But I think I'm finally getting it when we get to the fireman, which is exactly what it sounds like, but with ass spanking on the end. And she says something to me, and I'm like, oh, she looks impressed. I want to hear this. But I can't hear over the deafening music. And so I'm like, what? And she's like, what's your name? And I was like, oh, my name's Amy. And she's like, clasps her hands together and cocks her head to the side and gives me this really indulgent smile like you would give a toddler that's just said something kind of cute but really dumb. And she says, oh, you're sweet. It said on the website, everybody, you know, everybody gets sexy in there. But stripper Barbie just broke the news to this woman who looks like a 12-year-old Amish boy that was not happening for her. So, you know, the thing about trying new things and opening yourself to new experiences is that some of them really profoundly change your life and make you a better person, and others tell you who you are not, and I am not a pole dancer. So I finished the class, and, you know, I have a lot more fun after that because I'm like, I don't need to try to be sexy anymore because that's not happening. And, you know, I'm high-fiving these sexy stripper ladies and finish up the class. I don't use the other two classes with my Groupon. And I go home, and I tell Dan about it, and he's very proud of me for just going and trying and still foolishly optimistic that I'm going to find sexy someday. And we have a really good laugh about it that night, and Dan has a really good laugh about it. But when the laughter dies down, you've been a wonderful audience. Don't forget to tip your server.
That was Amy Rood. Amy's a librarian with a lot of hobbies. She likes improv, knitting, sewing, decorating, baking, and cocktails. She assured me her pole dancing days are over, but she did agree to pose near a pole for a photo for our Radio Extras page. You can see it at themoth.org, where you can also find extra material on almost any story you hear on the Moth Radio Hour. In a moment, we'll be back with two family stories, one in the rec room of a retirement home and another in a fast food restaurant at Newark Airport.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
You spoke and we listened. Saturdays on AM 580 now feature what we call the smartest afternoon in radio. We've added the Moth Radio Hour to the schedule at 1 o'clock, where it lives in perfect harmony with This American Life at noon, Radio Lab at 2, the TED Radio Hour at 3, Weekend All Things Considered at 4, and Big Picture Science at 5. Get smart. Join us Saturdays at noon when we present The Smartest Afternoon in Radio on WILL AM 580.
Our broadcast day is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to visit Promenade, the artfully affordable and exceptionally eclectic shop. More information on upcoming events is on KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jennifer Hickson. At the Story Slams, we hear a great range of stories. Many are funny, the sorts of stories you can't wait to tell your friends because it feels great to make people laugh. But people also bring deeper stories. These next two fall into that category, and both are about grandparents. The first story is from Robert Weinstein. He's currently in school studying library science. Here's Robert, live at the Moth.
In 1998, I went to visit my grandma Rose in a old folks' home in West Bloomfield, Michigan. At the time, she was 90, and I was 28, and I was about to go off for 2 years of grad school. This was the last time I ever saw her. Now, she'd been living there for about 15 years, and I'd been to visit her a lot, but lately, at that time, it was becoming a little bit sadder. One reason was because the place was full of people who were sort of grasping at the last stages of their lucidity. But even more, and that might sound like a horrible thing to say, and I kind of felt bad for thinking it, but the other reason was that it was taking her longer and longer to recognize me, and I didn't know how to handle that. But when I saw her on this day, she was really excited, because in the common room, they had a Sunday bar / Perry Como music hour. And I'm not a big fan of Perry Como, and I'm not a big fan of ice cream, but I'm a really big fan of Rose, so I was like, let's go. And when we got there, it didn't make my discomfort any better. First of all, the Perry Como was coming from a boombox that was at one end of the room, and there was this great big chasm. And on the other end, all these people were seated, and they were just staring at it. And my grandmother and I rolled over there, and she introduced me to everyone, saying, this is my grandson, and he's going to Paris, and they responded, how nice to meet you, and how handsome you are, and that's very nice. And then when everything was said and done, we just kind of settled, and I became one of them, and we just stared at that boombox. And this the silence was broken, though, by this woman in a wheelchair who was sitting next to me, who asked me if I'd ever heard of Perry Como before. And I told her I had, and she told me how much she loved him. Then she told me the story about during the war, her husband and all the men in her town, she didn't say which war, but all the men in her town were off fighting. And they really missed the men, but what they really missed was dancing. And they missed it so much that they would rent out a gymnasium once a month and get a record player, and they would play songs, and her favorite was Perry Como. And she went off into her head for a little while, and she looked like she was really enjoying herself. And finally she said, I really miss dancing. And I said, I was really tired of feeling uncomfortable, and I didn't know what else to say, so I said, do you want to dance? And she said, yes. So I wheeled her out into the middle of the Grand Canyon that was separating the people from the boombox, and I lifted her arm up and twirled under it, and I twirled her wheelchair around, and we laughed a lot, and we smiled a lot. And when it was over, I thanked her, wheeled her back, and I noticed a lot of little old ladies smiling at me. So I asked another one to dance. And she asked someone else to dance, and we danced again, and then we split off, and pretty soon we had snowballed into this great big geriatric cotillion. And it was quite something. And while I was dancing, I remember this thing that my grandmother's 75th birthday, and we were at this restaurant called the Pickle Barrel, and we were eating pickles out of this small barrel on a table. And I asked her what it was like to be 75 years old, and she said, without even thinking, she said, it feels like it always does. She says, my mind still feels very young, like about 18, but my body just won't do the things I want it to do anymore. And then she told me this theory that she had where people locked in to a certain age and they stayed that way for the rest of their lives. And it was kind of amazing. So back at the dance, I saw my grandmother across the room, and of course, I danced with her. And it was really great. I mean, when you're watching someone decline, it's really easy to get caught up in the deterioration and forget how much you love that person. And it was at this moment that I realized why that place made me feel so uncomfortable. It was good old complicated fear. It was a bunch of fears, actually. It was fear of watching her grow older and my powerlessness to do anything about it. And also the thought of losing her and my powerlessness to do anything about that. And then I realized watching everyone that if I felt that way, I couldn't even imagine what these guys felt like. And so the ice cream came. And some people stayed dancing. And some people made a beeline for the cart. And everybody was eating and dancing. And they looked like the ages that I presumed they felt. And they lit that room like chandeliers. And I stayed dancing with my grandmother. And I've realized over time how rare it is that you get to see someone as they see themselves. And there I was with this 18-year-old woman who was dancing with someone she loved, who loved her back. And I felt very, very lucky. Thank you.
That was Robert Weinstein. He reports that when he returned from France, he was able to see his grandmother one more time. In her honor, here's a little Perry Como.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger across a crowded room.
To see a photo of Robert and his grandmother, visit our website, themoth.org. This next story is from Jay Dixit. The theme that night was fathers, and it was his first time telling a story on stage. Here's Jay, live at The Moth.
It's my first time up here, so bear with me. So I'm eating sushi with my girlfriend in the East Village when my father calls and tells me that my grandmother in India is dying. I'd only actually met my grandmother a few times on trips to India, and she was from a completely different world. She was this old Indian woman with a bindi and a sari, and she didn't even speak English, and I don't speak Hindi, so the only way that we could communicate was through her cooking me delicious Indian food and me eating it and making happy gestures. I love those trips to India because my father would carry me around on his shoulders, and I remember thinking how strong he was and how big his hands were compared to mine. And I always felt safe up there because he would take my hand and he would hold it and he wouldn't let go. And maybe that's a happy memory because I was too young then to realize what an asshole my father is. Because the man I know today has a terrible temper, and whatever we talk about, he always finds a way to make it about how inadequate I am, which is exactly what happens on this phone call. He tells me my grandmother has cancer and only has a few days to live. He's flying to India the next day, and he has an 8-hour layover in Newark. And he says, "You can come and see me at the airport." And I say, "Well, yeah, definitely. I do have to work tomorrow, and I don't have any vacation days left. But yeah, I'll just explain the situation. I'll ask for a personal day." He says, "Why do you have to ask? I talked to you at the Big Shot senior editor. When one of my graduate students wants the day off, they take it, so long as they get their work done." And I'm like, "Well, maybe that's how it works in a physics lab, but that's not how it works at my job." And he says, "Well, then maybe you shouldn't be working there." I'm just like, "What?" I'm like, "Listen, I know you're going through a tough time right now." He goes, "I'm not going through a tough time, goddammit." I'm just like, "Okay, I'm trying to be nice, but if he's going to spin my empathy back in my face." So I say, "Got it. Your mother's on her deathbed, and it's not a tough time for you. Good to know." So he hangs up on me. I'm like, "Okay, no way I'm going to the airport now unless he apologizes." But the next day at work, all I can think about is my father all alone at Newark Airport. So I swallow my pride and I go, and I get there, and there he is, And I almost don't recognize him at first, because in my mind, my father will always be this towering, scary figure. But for a second, from a distance, I see him as he is, this tired old man with white hair sitting alone in an airport. And he sees me and he stands up, and I go to hug him, and he does what he always does, which is he pats me awkwardly on the back, and we walk over to the most solemn restaurant we can find in the airport, which is a Chili's, and we order fajitas, and he says, "Your grandmother's on life support. I'm the eldest son. They are waiting for me. Once I'm there, then we will pull the plug." And he starts telling me about the funeral arrangements, the 13 days of mourning, scattering the ashes on the river. And right at that moment, the waitress comes and she's like, "You guys ready for your guiltless fajitas?" At check-in time, we walk over to international departures, and as we're waiting in line, my father's cell phone rings, and he starts talking in Hindi. And I hear, "Hindi, Hindi, life support. Hindi, Hindi, lung failure. Hindi, Hindi, time of death, 1:27 a.m., New Delhi time." That's 10 minutes ago. And I want to console him, so I take my hand and I put it on his shoulder. But as you can probably guess, my father's not a very touchy-feely guy, and my hand just feels awkward and inappropriate, so I pull it away again. And he finishes his call, and he hangs up, and he doesn't even look at me. He just stares straight ahead, and he starts crying. And so I start crying, because I'm thinking, there must have been a moment years ago when he realized his mother wouldn't be around forever. Just like this moment, looking at my dad's red, swollen eyes and realizing he won't always be around for me to be mad at, for me to snap at on the phone, for me to visit at the airport. So he hangs up. So he hangs up. So finally, he composes himself, and he asks me to dial my brother so we can tell him the news. So I call my brother, but he doesn't pick up. So I send him a text message, and I say, "Time of death, 1:27 a.m. And I don't know what else to say, so I just put one of those little sad frowny face emoticons. And I immediately I regret it. I'm like, it's one of the sadder moments in my life. And OMG, I'm communicating like a teenage girl. So then we dial my mother on speakerphone. But she doesn't know she's on speakerphone. And she picks up and she says, "So is your father behaving himself?" And so I say, "Actually, he's right here with me right now, and you're on speakerphone." Then my father speaks up, and he says, "So, Bahoji is no more." And then he tries to continue, but his voice breaks, and he can't speak. And so I take my hand, and I put it on his shoulder again. But this time, I leave it there. And this time, he takes my hand, and he holds it, and he doesn't let go. And he says, "It is not easy, but it is okay because Jay is here with me." Thanks.
That was Jay Dixit. Jay writes for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Rolling Stone, and is former senior editor at Psychology Today. He's currently working on his first book, Love Versus Brain. To see a photo of him with his father, visit themoth.org. Coming up in a moment, our final story.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
The Emmy Awards have inspired us to feature some of our interviews with great actors in TV series on the next Fresh Air.
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No, I am the one who knocks.
We feature our interview with Bryan Cranston, who starred in Breaking Bad. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jennifer Hickson. Our next story is from Satori Shakur. Satori heard about our story slam in Detroit and decided to put her name in the hat. She got picked, started talking, and we loved her immediately. Since that first story, she's gone on to win a slam, compete in a grand slam, tell a main stage story in Detroit, and eventually make her way to the New York main stage, where she told a story for our show called Family Gatherings and Ungatherings. A word of caution, this story is full of passion and contains some adult themes and references, so be forewarned. Here's Satori Shakur, live at the Moth.
Six years ago, when they closed my mother's casket, I was devastated. I knew I would never be the same again. It was the day after Thanksgiving, and I could find little to be thankful for. I remembered holding her hand in the hospital and my sister the other when the doctor told us there was no hope, that the ovarian cancer had spread and it would be cruel to keep her on life support. Well, my mind froze in resistance to the news. I wasn't prepared to lose my mother yet. I had no concept of life without her in it. She was my mother, my teacher, my friend. I was so angry I couldn't control the outcome that I lashed out at the doctor in blame. And that's when I heard my mother's voice cut straight through my emotion. Well, doctor, I just want to thank you. Because y'all sure was nice to me. Thank you. Two words my mother taught me in childhood. And I watched that doctor's face change from failure to success in a nanosecond. And then I looked at my mother like something I'd never seen before. How deep does she have to dig to elevate his bedside manner over saving her life? And then she told my sister and me to go down to the gift shop and get one of them big thank you cards. You know, the funny kind. I got a lot of people to thank. Well, the only thing that I took from her modest estate was her wig. And I smelled it every day until the smell was gone. Now, I'm an actor, and I've been trained that the show must go on. And at the time, I was working in a show called Menopause, the Musical in Detroit. And my mother loved coming to see that show. And the show did go on, but sometimes I wore my pajamas under my costume. And the women in the cast, they were amazing, and I had great support. But there was nothing that could prepare me for the death of my son 9 months later. He died from a massive seizure as a result of a brain injury that happened in a car accident some years before. And when I kissed him goodbye, I was shocked at how cold his skin felt against my lips. And when they closed his casket, I died. I was a dead thing. When I looked at the rest of my life, it looked like a joyless chore to live. And I was traveling, performing, winning awards, and I felt nothing except relief that I was in England on Thanksgiving, and with no reminders that the day before would have been his 24th birthday. And had he been alive, I would have missed it. Well, I knew I needed help when I collapsed in the men's department of Macy's when I saw a mannequin dressed in something he might have worn. So I joined a grief support group, and I cried and screamed, and I talked and I listened through the stages of grief: denial, depression, anger, acceptance, and finally hope. I was so grateful to feel my feelings again. I didn't care what I felt. I wanted to live. I wanted to connect with my life, but I didn't know who I was anymore. I didn't know how or where to start. Well, I'm menopausal. I'm going through the change. So I didn't really have to worry about where to start. And there's a wisdom to menopause, and sometimes it can catch your body and your mind off guard. Well, I was in Kroger's in the vegetable department when my hormones just went out of whack. It was like somebody flipped the switch, and all of a sudden, I'm lusty as hell. I'm talking about hot, hot like a 15-year-old boy, hot like Halle Berry and Monster's Ball on the 4th of July. Because if it was me in that movie, I would have fornicated with Billy Bob Thornton and his racist daddy, too. And I look up and I see this man, and he is so fine. I'm like, damn, he looked good in that motorized wheelchair. I mean, he looked like one of those murder ball guys in that basketball documentary. I was just about to go over and introduce myself when I saw the flash of his wedding ring, so I turned my attention to the zucchini. And after that, I just started seeing zucchini everywhere. You know, I was surprised because I thought that when vaginal dryness met erectile dysfunction, it would be a perfect match. I don't want to, you can't, hey! I thought I would be content to just coast, have a little fun till I reached the promised land of dried up eggs and freedom from maxi pads. No, I was happy to be complacent, have an okay life, okay man, you know, book a cruise, wear matching outfits, and get fat at the all-you-can-eat buffet. Instead, I'm flashing truckers on I-75 in Trumbull in Detroit. I mean, I didn't recognize myself. This is not me. I'm a political junkie. I pride myself on keeping up on current events. I didn't realize how lonely I was. You know, how in need of a man's touch. And when I couldn't take it anymore, I went shopping for some stilettos. It was time to get me a man. So I went on Craigslist. Because, well, Craigslist deliver right now. And I spotted an ad that seemed sane to my sensibilities. Good looking, educated, house, car, job, gentleman at all times. Seeks mature lady for drinks, great conversation, and a possible relationship. So I programmed my GPS for Tom's Oyster Bar. And I ain't gonna say my standards were low walking in. Let's just say they were specific. If the man looked halfway decent and had a pulse, we get naked tonight. Now, I'm hoping that the bad boy with the sideburns at the end of the bar is him. And I get down there and that man looked good to me. Those luscious lips, those bedroom eyes, that big juicy Jewish nose, he looked like a Slurpee sitting on a bar stool. He said, "Oh my God, you're much more than I expected. You're beautiful." And I was hoping to meet a black woman. And I said, "Oh, why?" He said, "I don't know. Something different than black than white skin. Exotic." Now, exotic is a racist buzzword for me. But it didn't sound racist coming from him. Just sounded honest. So I felt comfortable being honest myself. And I said, "Well, I like Jewish men. And I like Italian men that look Jewish." But to be quite honest, I'm open to men of all races, long as they got a big schnozzle. And whenever I see a big banana nose, it makes me want to break out in a Jewish Negro spiritual. I mean, what did I have to lose being myself? So he laughed. I sat down at the bar, and we engaged in some stimulating conversation. Now, I'm surprised because he's telling me real things about his life, his real name. Now, at this point, my identity is hidden because, after all, he is a Craigslist date. You know, he's telling me about Three generations ago, his Russian Jewish family coming to America, starting a successful business. That he's an artist, studied in Italy, and now he deals in collectibles and antiques. Now I'm hanging on every word, but I'm distracted by all that juicy fruit on his face. But I'm a woman. I can multitask. I can do two things at once. I can listen to his life story and want to suck his lips off his face at the same time. So then we put our cards on the table. Why did you answer my ad? And I told him about my long journey from grief. And I told him how my hormones went out of whack and I was here to have a bang-up good old time. He said, well, sex is important to me too. And I can think of all kind of things to do with you, but I'm open for a relationship, and you look worthy of a relationship to pursue. Now, my heart stirred at the word relationship, but that should have been a red flag. Because relationship is a distraction, especially if you're just coming for one thing. And relationship is like a woman trap. It's a storefront of promises that you can't keep. And I wasn't sure whether I was ready for a relationship, whether I wanted to open up my heart and love and lose again. So when he asked me, did I want to come back to his house to see his African art collection? I said, yeah. So we get to his house, and it's like this whimsical folk art museum, art all over the walls. He said, go on upstairs, take a look around. I get upstairs to his bedroom, and there's all these framed concert posters. And on one wall, it said, Parliament Funkadelic, Brides of Funkenstein, Paris, France, 1979. I said, that's me. He said, oh, yes, that's one of my most valuable posters. That's my favorite group. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm one of the Brides of Funkenstein. I used to sing with Parliament Funkadelic. I was there. He said, no, I said, yeah, So we look at each other like we both struck gold. And he takes me downstairs and serenades me on his guitar. And we both decided, well, I decided I'm going to keep my panties up, check this out for a few days. A few days later, we made love, and it was amazing. I mean, every cell of my body felt connected to him. I mean, my screams felt like I was releasing grief and embracing joy. It was just magical. And the first month, we hit a wrinkle, ironed it out. Second month, I was like all over him. I wanted him all the time. Woo, I just want to make your dreams come true. We hit a bump, worked it out. Third month, I said, well, do you want to come over to my sister's house for Thanksgiving? He said, I want to be by myself on Thanksgiving. Satori, you're too much for me. You're too intense. You're too analytical. You talk too much. And I've never met anybody who wants to share all of her feelings. I can't handle a girlfriend right now. Well, at first, his words, they hurt. You know, it took the wind out of my sails. But then I knew he was telling the truth because I understand complacency. I recognize it as a welcome respite on the way to peace and joy. I recognize that complacency can do nothing more than hope. And then I thought, wow, it hit me. I'm too much. I'm way more alive. And so grief had taught me how to lose and how to live and how to win. So I told him, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate your honesty. And I appreciate your honesty. And you have given me so much. And I thought of those two words that my mother taught me, thank you. And I told him, but just so you know, because he wanted to be my friend. He said, I want to be your friend. I'm your biggest fan. I said, just so you know, if I come across as being too much, you have my mother, my son, and my raging hormones to thank. Because I'm going for being way too much. I'm going for being over the top alive. I'm going for kissing the lips off the face of life. And everybody in it, because I'm alive. So thank you very much.
Ambulance, I love the feeling on this lovely ear. Overcome of hell.
That was Satori Shakur. She's a writer and actor. Satori told me about her favorite feedback from telling that story.
So after I told that story, there were a lot of men that came up to me with big noses, and they were just talking to me with their profiles. They wanted me to see the length, the breadth, and everything of their noses. And I thought that was really funny.
Satori comes from a long line of storytellers.
I was raised by these real old ladies from the South, and that's how everybody communicated. My stepmother, we would go to the mailbox to mail a letter, and she would make it sound like Lord of the Rings. The mailbox could talk. She would open the lid real slow, and the letter would go down, and a dragon would pick, and it'd fly across the world at night, you know, when people were sleeping, take it to the destination.
That's it for this episode of the Moth Radio Hour. We hope you'll join us next time, and that's the story from the Moth.
Your host this hour was the Moth's senior producer, Jennifer Hickson. Jen also directed the stories in this hour, along with Sarah Austin Jeunesse. The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Jenna Weiss-Berman and Brandon Echter. Moth Stories Are True is remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Lawless Music, The West Side Horns, Tony Evans,